The following podcast is brought to you in support of the Norman Mailer Society. Please visit us at www.normanmailersociety.org today to become a member.
Ivan Fisher, who was his lawyer, said, he goes, did you feel like Norman was your best friend? And I said, yeah, I did. I did a lot of times. I felt that we were really that close. He said, so did I. And he said, so did a lot of people. And he said, that was Norman's gift. And a lot of people thought that they were his best friend.
Sure.
So he had that kind of a sensibility. He needed a lot of best friends in his life.
I'm Justin Bozon. You know, I can't think of a better way to start off this first episode of the Mailer Society podcast than by speaking with Mike Lennon. As Norman Mailer's archivist and official biographer, Lennon knew Norman Mailer for over 30 years, and he collaborated on such books with him as Conversations with Norman Mailer, On God, The Time of Our Time, and The Spooky Art. In 2013, Random House published Lennon's definitive bio on Mailer, A Double Life, and just last year, Random House also published Lennon's latest project, a collection of letters that Norman Mailer wrote over his 50-year career, The Selected Letters of Norman Mailer. And what follows today is a chat I had with Lennon a couple weeks back about The Selected Letters. I mean, because this is a podcast, and you know, there are people that I'm sure that may discover it or listen to it that aren't necessarily familiar with The Selected Letters or haven't read it yet. Like, I wanted to ask you if you could explain how they came to fruition. Because, I mean, you have the biography and then you have The Selected Letters. So, I mean, how did the exchange come about where the biography came first and The Selected Letters?
We go back to, back to the year 2002, when Mailer was still alive. I went to him with the idea of putting together an edition of his letters. I was his archivist at that point, along with Robert Lucid. Lucid was writing his biography. He was in the middle of that, and the letters needed to be done. And so I read a lot of the letters, and I went to Mailer, and I said, what do you think about this? He said, great, go ahead and do it. Lucid was all for it, too, and we went to work, both of us. Lucid had been working on it for many years, on the biography. And I began editing the letters, and from 2002, I worked on them off and on all the way up to 2006. At the end of 2006, when I was about 80% done with the letters, having taken them up to the year 2000, we decided at that point we were going to stop at 2000, 60 years of letters, 1940 to 2000. At that point, Robert Lucid sadly died unexpectedly. And when he died, I was asked to take over the biography. I'd always been the understudy for that job. It was always kind of understood that I would take over, and I did. Well, I wanted to publish the letters. I was almost done with them. I put in 5 or 6 years on them. It's a vast task of reading all the letters. And I had, at that point, read almost all the letters, 40, 50,000 letters. Everyone said, no, you should do the biography first and then the letters, because you want to tell the story completely via the biography, the story of Mailer's life, and not in fragments if you publish the letters. The letters certainly are biographical in nature or autobiographical in nature, and they would reveal a lot about Mailer, but it wouldn't be a full story. There'd be gaps and holes and what have you. And, you know, I finally, Mailer said, yes, that's the way to do it, and so did his wife, and so did his agent, and my agent, and editors, and everyone said that's the way to do it. So with some regret, initially at least, I put the letters aside and I began writing the biography, and I worked on the biography for 6 years, finished it around in 2012, and as I was editing that, I went back to the letters again and finished the letters, I guess in mid-2014, and they came out in December of 2014. Looking back, it was all quite fortuitous, because I was in the position of having read all the letters before I embarked on the biography. That was not the case for Bob Lucid. He was reading them as he went along. So he'd be writing, let's say, about Mailer in World War II. He'd read all the letters from World War II. He didn't read them all, so he didn't have the benefit of Mailer's retrospective comments on his own works and on his own life. I had that. So I could say that, 20 years later, Mailer, looking back, said this and this about such and such a book or such and such a person in his life. So it was all, it wasn't planned that way. It was just luck and fortune and fate that made it happen that way. And, you know, now that the both books are out, one coming out at the end of 2013, the biography, and the letters coming out at the end of 2014, it seems, you know, that I was a very fortunate guy.
Right. And, and the thing is I think what people don't understand always, too, is that you knew him for, what, over 30 years. I mean, you watched his kids grow up. You both lived in New England. I mean, in putting together the Double Life and then the Selected Letters, was there something or, you know, that you learned from culling through every piece of paper that I have? Were there any surprises that maybe you know, you hadn't discussed with him or something you didn't foresee coming?
Yes. Of course, endless surprises, endless. I mean, I had the, you know, I had the arc of his life in mind. I knew what it was. I'd read enough about him. I'd read that, you know, there were four biographies before mine. Then none of them got him up past, 1991? So they were missing the last 17 or 18 years of his life. But I'd read all those. I'd read everything, every interview ever done with him. I knew all the arc of his life. It wasn't that I was going to discover, you know, that he had moved to South America for 5 years and I didn't know about it. I knew all the major events. I knew all the main contours. What I didn't have were the details, the small details of the nature of a relationship with this or that person, or the struggle that went into write this or that book, or how some parts of his life informed other parts, the financial problems he had, the romantic problems he had, his relationships with his wives, and so on. All of that was helpful material that filled in. So I had a mosaic, and I knew the shape of the overall shape of the mosaic, but there were a lot of tiles missing. And so in the process of writing the biography and reading the letters, I filled in all those, not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them. Part of it was doing the interviews with about 80 people I interviewed who knew him, including his children, his sister, his nephew, some of his wives who were alive, and many of his friends and editors, and old girlfriends. None of that had been, most of those people had not been interviewed before. I would say half the people I interviewed had really never been interviewed before, including all of his family. They had always kept them out of it. So every time I interviewed one of his children, or a girlfriend, or an editor, or something, often they would tell me things that I didn't know, and that no one knew. But it was more like fleshing out the nature of the relationship, telling incidents and anecdotes that occurred in his life that I did not know. Many times they would tell me things, and I knew everything they told me. But many times that wasn't the case. So, you know, you're like a prospector. You're out digging, and, you know, you're going over ground that's been gone over before, but every once in a while you find a nugget that someone missed. And in my case, I not only found nuggets that other prospectors had missed, I found whole veins of gold that no one was aware of, and, you know, that would be in the relationships that he had with all people. We knew he had a relationship with this or that person. He had a romance, had an affair with someone. It was known. But that person had never been interviewed. So it was filling in the blanks of his life that we're missing, adding those tiles. I'm mixing my metaphors here, I know, terribly, but that's what it was. So it was not, there was never any, you know, huge discovery that of the kind that some biographers have, because I'd lived too close to his life and talked to him about his life, you know, for many, many years, and for the last, you know, 4 years of his life, really. You know, I lived in Provincetown, and I saw him every day, and I talked to him, and he'd tell you anything. He told me everything. He never said, "Oh, I can't tell you that. Oh, that's off the." No, he wasn't like that at all. He wanted to tell you everything, and if he held anything back, I don't know what it was.
There's one thing and it's probably, you know, typical with the Selected Letters volume of any author. There's a fun intimacy in the collection, and I mean, I find the letters quite extraordinary, that, you know, the exchanges with his parents during his days at Harvard, or while, you know, he's over in places like Japan, for example, during World War II. I mean, he writes you know, of ideas for short stories. He's cordially accepting suggestions from those close to him about topics or themes he should write about. I mean, looking back, you know, at those letters, the years later, did he give you any insights into them in the sense that, like, you know, maybe he said, well, I was too naive here, or, you know, I shouldn't have said this to this person.
Oh, sure, sure he did. Sure he did. Yeah, he read all the letters that I selected, and he approved of them. He didn't say, no, don't use that one. I think he said, maybe you've got too many letters in the 50s. He said, why don't you think about cutting them back? And he was right, I did. I cut them back a little bit. He was looking at them as a professional. He would say, boy, wasn't I naive then, or wasn't I cocky then, or what I didn't know then, all the things that we say about ourselves when we're older and we look back at our youth. He said those things. What he was most helpful with me about was, I would say, I don't know this person. This person has written you these 5-10 letters. Who is this person? This person, you met somebody in Hollywood, and who was this person? And he would say, oh, that was so-and-so. And he would explain. He would give me, we did a whole series of interviews, which I taped, of him saying, okay, let me tell you who that person was. He'd give me a quick 3 or 4 sentences on the person. What was his relationship with that person, and who they were, and where they met, and how they met, and so on, and why he found them interesting. That was extremely valuable, because some of the people, of course, I didn't have to ask them, because I knew the person. But there were some people who were dead, who were gone and forgotten and were not famous names that he corresponded with, that he was able to tell me who they were. And so that was a great, great help to me in having him right there and having him read the letters. And he would sometimes, you know, write a note in the margin, or I would just sit down and ask him questions and take notes. Many times I just wrote them down. Other times I actually taped them. And so I had an asset that few biographers and few editors of a selection of letters ever have, and that is, I've got the guy right there and I can ask him. Now, there are many things, there are any number of little things I say, God, I wish I'd asked him this. I wish I'd asked him that. But that's, of course, you're never going to get to the bottom to know every single detail of any human life. It's just too complex.
Yeah, one of the, I think, sort of most difficult letters to chew in the, I think it's in the 50s section, is the letter, a really nasty letter he writes to his dad about his gambling problem. Did they ever talk about aftermath?
Yes, I did talk with him about it, and he said, boy, he said, I was really harsh with him. He said, but he said, you know, at the time, he said, you know, we were just basically coming out of the Depression and out of the war, and we had such a tough time during the Depression that, you know, I was angry at my father because he had basically been a burden on the family as far financially, off and on. I mean, his father would work and he'd do well, but then his father would go out and gamble. And so, you know, supporting the family fell on the back of his mother, and there was a lot of resentment about that. Now, he certainly admired his father's audacity and his gambling in some ways, but in other ways, the notion that, you know, his father had just blown $5,000 in the 1940s, that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what people made in a year. So you've got to say it's like $50,000 today. And, you know, Norman had just gotten his checks, you know, for The Naked and the Dead, and his father actually was investing some of that money. He was his bookkeeper and everything. And, you know, was pilfering money here and there, as Mayer was said. So he was very angry at his father. And he had to be very angry to write that kind of a letter. And, of course, it did no good at all because, I don't know if you read the note, but his father went out and doubled it.
Right, right.
And they paid it off.
Yeah.
They paid it off, every penny of it. So, you know, it was a real family trauma. It didn't separate Norman from his father. He loved his father dearly. But it was a moment of anger that sometimes that happens in families.
Sure. I think my two favorite sections in the selected letters are the 40s and the 50s, just because I feel like you get an almost month-by-month sort of sequencing of what things were happening, you know, and sort of how he was sort of dreaming up the initial ideas for The Naked and the Dead, and in particular in letter, I think it's 34, you know, he talks about the real men who served with him overseas, like Donald Mann, and you see Drew Martinez as being the inspirations for the characters. I mean, did he ever hear back from those guys in the years that followed, and find out what they had thought of what he had written?
Very few, very few. He heard back from some people. I actually got in touch with one guy who we went through basic with, and actually rode back on the troop ship back. I can't think of the guy's name, but the guy was in his late 80s, and I talked to him, and he told me what he had told other biographers, but he gave me a couple of things. A few people wrote to him from the Army. A few folks wrote to him and remembered their time together. Martinez, I never saw the letter, but apparently Martinez, who was the sergeant he lives on this tripwire between fear and boldness. He's the one that goes behind the lines and cuts the throats of the Japanese soldiers in The Naked and the Dead, and he was based on a real character. And I believe Martinez got in touch with him somehow and wanted to know, well, you know, are you basing this book on me? And Martinez was looking like, then if you are, then I want to get, I'd like to get a check in the mail. And he said, oh, no, I wasn't basing it on you. It's a common name. But he was indeed basing it on Martinez.
Right, right.
And it's very clear that he was.
Yeah, I kind of poked at that name a little bit online, and I came up with there's a famous guy with that name who invented a prosthetic limb, and I thought that was interesting in the sense that it very well could have been him if he was injured in the war, but probably a coincidence. But
no, he wasn't injured in the war. No,
oh, okay.
he came out of it without a scratch. The same thing happened to James Jones. You know, he the guy that I can't think of his name now, Pruitt's friend, Maggio. Mm-hmm. Who was played by Frank Sinatra in the movie,
right,
was based on a real character who worked in a department store in Brooklyn, and he sued James Jones.
Wow.
He sued him, yeah, and they settled. They settled. Jones didn't even change his name. And the guy said, hey, you know, Frank Sinatra's playing me in the movie, and your book's a bestseller, and so, well, I guess they gave him a check.
There's a lecture I'm fond of that Norman gave at Penn in 2001. And he talks about the nature of writing, and you know, there's he talks about like how he only knows two ways how to write a book. The first of which is to produce a detailed outline, you know, map out the plot and the characters, and you know, in the selected letters, he talks through those 40s letters, you know, even before he returns from the war, about how he plans to do exactly that when he gets back, you know, mapping out the plot, the characters, the theme, the metaphors, sort of, you know, getting it all set before he writes. So I wanted to know if, like, that was something he did regularly with books that would come after The Naked and the Dead?
No, he never did it again. Never. In fact, he didn't really even do it that much in The Naked and the Dead. What he did in The Naked and the Dead was he had character sketches of all of the major characters, and he would write a little sketch of them. He had index cards, and on the index card, he put down the characteristics of all the characters, and he used those as a kind of a guide. But he didn't have a detailed outline.
Okay.
We know that because General Cummings, you know, was added after the book was you know, essentially the first draft of the book was written,
right.
And then General Cummings was added. And then when it was criticized at Little Brown, Bernard DeVoto said, you know, Cummings isn't very well drawn, and Mailer said he was right, and Mailer changed that again. And those conversations between Cummings and Hearn were added at the end of the book. He knew that he was going to have them go to the island, fight the Japanese, win the island, and leave. He had that plot, which is a very simple plot and really was dictated by historical circumstances. He knew that was going to happen. But what was going to happen on the island, all the different incidents, some of them based on reality, like the Hornet's Nest, some of them which he made up, he was never much of a planner or an outline. In fact, he said somewhere that every time he did try to put an outline, he found it didn't work as it tied his hands. He was an organic writer, first and last. But, you know, he was an engineer in college, and he had a lot of time for planning when he was in the service. And so he did a lot of planning because he couldn't do an awful lot of writing, real writing. He could write letters to his wife with descriptions and so forth. But If you look at the material in the notes down in Texas of what he actually did, you find out there's some sketchy stuff there. Of course, he did some kind of outlines. You know, sure. He had little charts and things like that. But it wasn't the kind of an outline that. I mean, I know writers who have spreadsheets and they have every chapter outlined, and you know they have 5,000 words on each chapter, and then they go back in and they just expand. I know a guy that does a spreadsheet. Writes all of his novels. He's written 37 novels, you know, and that's how he does it. But you know, they're kind of wooden. You know, they don't. I mean, they're well written, they're thoughtful, and so and all that. He's a fine writer, but you never get the sense that there's any. You know, the spontaneity of it is a little weak. So it's there are some people that can do it that way and are successful, and some people that can't. But Mailer always said no. It was the book of a young engineer. And it was really the only book he ever wrote that there was even a modicum of advanced planning.
Sure. You know, when we come to the mid to late 50s, you know, there's that lengthy process of writing The Deer Park. And he walks through what is seemingly a long period of writer's block. I mean, or if it's, is it fair to call it writer's block? And why do you think that happened to him as it did?
Well, The Deer Park was a difficult a problem for him because he was shifting points of view. When he wrote The Naked and the Dead, he told it as if he were a Victorian novelist. He went into the heads of 20 different characters, and he did it with great facility and ease. When he shifted to the next, then he began thinking a lot about literature and thinking about point of view and reading E.M. Forster and reading Isherwood and reading a lot of different people and trying to tell a story in a different way. And so when he told Bob Reshore, he used Isherwood's Sally Bowles stories, which had a first-person narrator, as his way of doing it. And, you know, the book was a failure in many ways. It had some brilliant stuff in it, but when he came to the, he hadn't resolved his point of view problems. And when he came to the Deer Park, he had one big giant problem. He wanted this book to be told in the first person to give it immediacy and credibility. He knew all the virtues of talking in the first person because you don't have all the obligations to understand the psychology of 20 different characters. He didn't want to do that. He wanted that immediacy. As if somebody was talking the story to you or writing it to you. On the other hand, he had scenes in the book that caused him an immense amount of difficulty, and those were scenes that the narrator could not have known about. There were scenes in the bedroom scenes.
Right.
The whole affair between Eitel and Elena, which is the what he really wanted to write about. But he found, how am I going to write about? I'm stuck with this narrator. And so he basically just violated all the rules of point of view, and he knew he was doing it. He just shifted point of view and started writing in the omniscient point of view again. And so the book, you know, shifts points of view. There's like 30 shifts in points of view. So it caused him that was an agony from him. And then he felt that the narrator of the novel was too much, sounded too much like him. And so he wanted somebody who, I mean, the narrator, you know, Sergius O'Shaughnessy is supposed to be someone who was an orphan, who lived in an orphanage and came up the hard way. And then, you know, somehow became a pilot and flying jets and burning villages in Korea. And, you know, this was nothing like Mailer, who had come from a, you know, a pretty nice middle-class background, you know, with a loving family. He didn't sound like, he didn't sound like an orphan. And so Mailer had to go back. That was another problem he had. He had to go back and make Sergius a different character. And if you look at the first draft of The Deer Park, and you look at the last draft of The Deer Park, you see a big difference. The Reinhardt version versus the Putnam's version are much different. And it's mainly in that. But he never solved the problem of the point of view. He just gave up on it. Just did it. And, you know, some people have read it, including Alberto Moravia, the great Italian novelist who was a friend of Mailer's, and he said, why do we have this narrator? This narrator doesn't have any function. Why don't you just tell the story?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was really Mailer's solution, but he couldn't give up the first person. So all of his life he struggled with point of view, all of his life, and he made resolved it. The great resolutions are in The Armies of the Night, when he writes about himself in the first person to get away from that I. And then in Executioner's Song, when he goes back to the point of view of the naked and the dead, and but having all that material to rely on, so he doesn't have to make up the psychologies of 20 people. He's got it all down from Larry Schiller's interviews, his interviews.
Right.
And then finally in The Castle in the Forest, where he finally solves the problem completely by having a first-person narrator who is also omniscient, a devil, who can read people's minds.
Right.
So he finally solved the problem in his last book. And
sure.
He knew it. Anybody talk to him about it. So if you, in one sense, if you want to, an aesthetic study of Norman Mailer's writing really has to be a study of point of view and the relation of Mailer to his material. What was it and how he modulated that over, 50 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And is it a strange coincidence that in letter 120, which I believe comes right out of the heart of the 50s, he suggests...
Wait, no, say that one again.
I said, is it a strange coincidence that in letter 120... which I believe comes right out of the heart of the 50s, he suggests that in his lifetime he'd be married 6 times.
Yeah, isn't that it's a wonderful irony. He got a kick out of that, by the way. He got a kick out of it. Yeah. And Adele didn't like it at all. But, I had to put that in. It was something he just said, but, he was very prescient. He realized that, he was not going to be happy with one woman.
Well, it's funny because at times the letters to me serve as if almost they're like an analyst couch to him in a way. Like, he was so keen about, being at the conference last year and listening to some of the, the presentations about what he called his family tapestry and not being unwoven. And yet something that's, so intriguing to me is that we get so many instances where he writes these sort of really sincere, honest letters to his friends. And he says, he's often, and I'm sort of paraphrasing, he says, "I'm surprised how much I love this or that child." As if, the possibilities of love were sort of miraculous to him. I mean, did he ever comment on that stuff like that?
Well, there was a great division in his life between his family and his work. And he had a lot of regrets because he always, in his early years especially, put his work first. And it caused great stress because, and then he'd feel guilty and he would spend time he would spend time with his children in the summertime. In a way, it's kind of trying to catch up.
Right.
So you had that tension was always there, he had a lot of regrets that he didn't spend more time with his family, because he was a family man and he did love his kids. But the thing was, he felt, I've been given this talent. I've been given to it. It's a God-given talent. I have it. And what am I supposed to do with it? Am I supposed to ignore it? Should I forget about it? If it's an important talent, and he believed it was an important talent, if it's an important talent, then it's my duty, it's my obligation to exercise that talent. And that must mean that, something's going to have to give on the family front. And it did. But then he didn't like it. He said, okay, and everything's fine. No, he didn't like it at all. And later on in life, he tried to make up for it and spend more time with his kids. But it was a tension. It's Yeats who said, "You can either have a wife, or you can have your art, or you can have a wife. You can't have them both."
Right.
And
right.
He lived in that dilemma.
Yeah, there's an incident that I've heard others speak of it, and I've read about it, but there's that incident that is covered in detail in the selections in the 50s, in his encounter while he's out walking his dogs one evening. He gets into a fight and his opponents get the best of him. Do you think that incident had anything to do with how he would go on to view violence in subsequent years? It seems like such a moment, and he writes about it over several years almost embarrassed to have been bested.
I think it was after that moment. He never felt too badly about that moment because he felt like, all right, I fought these guys, and they were bigger and stronger than me. And this guy gouged my eye. So it was an honor. He felt it was an honorable loss. He didn't feel, but in compensation, when he moved, and he moved to Connecticut right after that fight, not because of it. He'd already bought the house there, but when he moved there, he started, you know, boxing.
Yeah.
That's when he did the boxing with his father-in-law, who had been a professional boxer and a club fighter, Adele's father, who was a really good fighter and knocked Norman out.
Right.
So, you know, there was always that tension there that, you know, he was not going to be pushed around. But, you know, he found out that he better become a better fighter if he was going to survive, and he did become a better fighter. He became, you know, a decent boxer and, you know, able to take care of himself better than he did in that fight which has been distorted in so many ways, you know, that they said there were... I've read that so many different accounts of that. They're all wrong. I mean, the two letters that he wrote, mm-hmm. one to Baldwin and one to Mickey, one to Knox and one to Malachi, I think. Tell the story is clearly, you know, and they repeat each other beautifully, and it was much more accurate. It was, I forget. There's so many distortions of. But that's inevitable. You know, there's so many events in Mailer's life that were distorted. And you're never going to be able to change them.
Sure. You know, one thing I was kind of hoping to talk about, too, is the Mailer-Picasso connection, you know, because I'm working on this idea myself. And you know, I wanted to see, because, firstly, in the Picasso book, we have the preface where he talks about his first attempt at writing a book about Picasso in the early 60s. And then in Letter 290, he writes... You know, he's talking about it again. He writes something about how he got 100 pages in and he couldn't do it. So I wanted to know, like, if you had read those 100 pages in your research, and how do they differ in approach or form from how the Picasso book comes out? That was
the 100 pages that he's talking about. There's no unwritten Picasso. There's no manuscript out there, Picasso. What he's talking about are the two self interviews that you find in presidential papers.
Okay.
Candles and Christians, the metaphysics of the belly and the political economy of time. Both of those were, he was going to work his way into the Picasso book. Those are the 100 pages.
Okay.
There's nothing else. There's a very short piece called An Eye on Picasso.
Right.
That he published too, and that's the only other thing. There's no manuscript down there where he's talking about Picasso's paintings or anything like that. No, nothing. That's what it was. And you'll see Picasso is mentioned in, I don't know which one, The Political Economy of Time or Metaphysics of the Belly. I think the latter. He's mentioned, but only in passing. He never got to it.
He's mentioned all over the place in the work, and that's sort of why it's an interest to me, is that line in Cannibals as Christians where he says Picasso was the pretext on which I discuss 1,000 different things.
Yeah. He loved a couple things about Picasso. First of all, he loved the fact that Picasso had a different style for every project, and he thought, that matches me. He saw Picasso's styles change every time he had a new marriage or a new mistress. Same for Mailer.
Right.
The two things he felt were in common. Third, Picasso's paintings were always about states of being which are undergoing some sort of transformation. Mm-hmm. And that was Mailer's theory of cubism, that it was a breakdown of being transmogrifications when one thing turned into another. And, you know, if you read Mailer's poems and Deaths for Ladies, you'll see that really that's the clue to understanding those poems. They're all about transformations. They're all about changes of state, of molecules going. And it's the same thing as in Metaphysics of the Belly. He's fascinated with that.
And that's how they look on the
so
page.
He saw that in Picasso as well.
I said that's how the words look on the page in Deaths for the Ladies, too.
Yeah,
you know,
the
words are sort of, they're almost like paintings.
Yeah, they're dripping, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking of Deaths for the Ladies, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but, you know, because it's been written about so much, but with that book and the stabbing, you know, I mean, how did he take flack for, I mean, it seems, you know, the really gutsy to come out with that title for a book of poetry, considering what had just happened to him a year or two before with that stabbing. So, I mean, I know a lot of people read into that, but I mean, how did he take that when people sort of
said, look, you're never going to, there's a poem in there that says, if you use a knife, there's some love left. And everybody has assumed that that was about why he stabbed Adele. But actually, it was a story told to him when he was in Bellevue. He made that clear two or three times. and indeed wrote letters to the guy and became friendly with the guy and helped the guy and everything, and this guy stabbed his brother, and that's what the story was about. But nobody ever believed them. Secondly, deaths for the ladies doesn't have anything to do with stabbings. It has to do with orgasms.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And he said, but he said, no one's going to believe that. Now, did he know that it was going to be a double meaning? Sure he did. Mm-hmm. Was he using it? Yeah, I think so. Just like he used it in American Dream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it was very clear that Deborah Coughlin in An American Dream, the wife, Rojak's wife, is made up in part of Adele, but really is very much like Lady Jean Campbell.
Right.
And so it's a composite. And Cherry, the singer, is a composite of Carol Stevens and Beverly Bentley. You see, he's four of his wives in that book. Yeah, four of them.
Yeah.
And he knew people would see it, and he knew it was going to be there. On the other hand, he said, this is my material. This is what I've got. This is the material I've got. Finally, you know, Mailer was a very autobiographical writer.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of American Dream and that sort of, you know, ego and ambition of the '60s, like I love the line that he writes in Letter 290, and I'm not sure if I've got the exact quote down, but it's like he says, "I'm not so grandiose as to compare myself with Dostoevsky directly, but it's necessary to say that no one has tried to write this way before or since." I mean, did he,
yeah.
Was that, I mean, really his, was he, I mean, in terms of ambition, was he pushing that hard in the '60s when he comes into American Dream?
Because Dream comes in. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
He was pushing very, very hard. And so on the one hand, he says, I'm not comparing myself to Dostoevsky. And then what does he do? He compares himself to Dostoevsky.
Yeah.
And he does that all the time. That's one of his techniques. Well, I'm not going to compare myself to so-and-so. However, I have to say that we do share this characteristic. So, you know, come on, you know, and that was one of his rhetorical tricks. To say, well, I can't really say that I'm a terrific boxer or anything like this, but on the other hand, I did do that. So he was always doing that. And, you know, I don't think that it is sufficiently recognized what a feat that was. No one has done that since, that I know of. I don't know any American novelist who's taken that kind of a dare, sat down and said, I'm going to publish a novel. You know, I haven't seen one. If there is one, I'm sure maybe there is. You never know. There's somebody out there. But has anyone done it successfully since An American Dream?
Yeah, right.
You have to go back to Dickens and Dostoevsky before you find it, because people like Thomas Hardy, Hemingway, there were so many people who did publish their novels in a serial form, but they had them all written first. And they were just basically milking him for income. You know, Hardy did it, you know, for all of his novels, but he always had them all written before he published them, and had a chance to revise them. Mailer didn't have that chance. And yet, I believe it's one of his most successful books. I always believe that.
Yeah, yeah. You know? Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because the one thing I kind of wanted to ask you about, too, is, you know, and this is sort of a test for you, right? So I wanted to know how important letter 585 was to you personally. And because I know you're not going to know the number. So it's the letter that Norman writes to you. Right? It's the letter that Norman writes to you after you've written him about the deer park. And he says, you know, you're the only guy I've ever explained any of my books to. So, I mean, like, does that sort of...
Oh, yeah.
Was the deer park... I mean, it seems like, because you spend so much time on it, was the deer park sort of the jumping in point for you in terms of discovering Mailer?
No, it wasn't. Advertisements for myself was.
Okay.
I had read The Deer Park. My mother gave me a copy of The Deer Park. I still have it, a paperback. I'd read it. I don't think I understood it. I read it, you know, I was too young. I was in college. But when I was about 28, I read, and I just started graduate school, I read Advertisements for Myself. That was the book that... Well, it pushed me back to the deer park, because it's so much of Advertisements is about the deer park.
Mm-hmm.
It's written in the wake of the deer park, so you can't really separate them, and I couldn't in my own mind. But that was the book that really made me recognize the brilliance of Mailer's style, the boldness of his ambition, the willingness to... put himself out there in public and not be afraid to say, I can do this, not his boldness. I thought his ambition was so American, it was so bold, it was so creative. And that line you're talking about in Letter 585, you know, I was touched by that when I got it. But, you know, he said that thing, he said things like that to a lot of people who wrote him letters.
Well, it's funny because then...
He was very sweet. He was very sweet. It was a very sweet thing, but he would say that to other people as well.
Well, and then
he would say, you know, I nobody really understands my work like you do. I mean, he said that to a number of people.
Oh,
I mean,
okay.
I know he said it to people like Barry Leeds. I know he said it to people like Bob Beghibe. He said things like that to Phil Buffett. He said them to a lot of different people. You know, I think I had a great relationship with him, and I think, you know, in many ways it was a relationship that no one else ever had, because it went on so long, and, you know, it culminated in allowing me to write his biography,
right.
You know, a lot of other critical stuff and books and so on. I'm still doing it. I'm still working on, you know, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm willing to say, yeah, I was a unique person in his life, but I was not by any means the only person. And that's one of the things you learn when you, with Mailer, is that, I remember Ivan Fisher, who was his lawyer, said, he goes, did you feel like Norman was your best friend? And I said, yeah, I did. I did a lot of times. I felt that we were really that close. He said, so did I. And he said, so did a lot of people. And he said, that was Norman's gift. And a lot of people thought that they were his best friend.
Sure.
So he had that kind of a sensibility. He needed a lot of best friends in his life.
Sure.
And he had a lot of best friends in his life. And he was able to juggle all that. And I think one of the interesting and unsaid things about Mailer is that Mailer's friends are all friends themselves.
Right, right.
There are not his friends are not divided into camps and factions. I mean, there's Manso, who is a special case, who was very close to him and broke away. But, you know, there were no other people like that. All the other people in Mailer's life, I'm thinking of Bob Lucid, I'm thinking of John Aldridge and Mickey Knox, Barry Leeds and myself. I'm thinking of, you know, Lillian Hellman and Diana Trilling. And there's so many people. There was no animosity among his Mailer's friends and supporters. Most of them, to this day, the ones that are still alive, are friendly. You know,
yeah.
You name it. Gay Talese and Pete Hamill, Don DeLillo, you know, those are people, you know, that I know. I don't know Hamill very well, mm-hmm. but I know Talese and DeLillo, and I knew Aldridge, and, you know, I knew them all. And there was never any jealousy, let us say, very little jealousy among his circle.
Sure. And then, well, to follow up that 585 letter, there's a letter that's, it's numbered 593, where Mailer writes to you again, and he tells you how much he enjoyed a piece you had written. I think it was a book review, I believe, and he says, I still don't know what deconstructionalism is, and that next time we get together, you're going to have to explain it to me. So did you ever get together with him, and what did he have to say about it?
I explained it to him 7 times. He never got it. He just could never get it. He never got it. I explained it to him over and over. I mean, in one sense, he knew what it was because he wrote about it in the letter to Gordon Lish. He understood
right.
it. But in another sense, when you explain it to him in a theoretical way, he could never get his arms around it. But you know what? A lot of people couldn't get their arms around deconstructionism, and didn't, because it didn't really make any sense in some ways. And and so he would. Yeah, we did. We did talk about it several times.
Well, in a strange way, isn't he deconstructing himself with books like Cannibals and Christians and Advertisements for Myself?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he wouldn't call it classic Derridean deconstruction, though. You know, but, you know, yeah, you can make a good case that it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could.
And then, you know, to go back to the Deer Park again real fast, there, you know, there's that letter, I can't remember the woman who writes it to him, but I believe it's 591, where she writes about, like, she wants to know, like, why he's so obsessed with the Deer Park. It's like, it seems like it's the novel that got away from, like, you know, there's all these rewrites, you know, there's the Theater de Lis play, there's the, you know, he wants to turn it into a film. He's working with Joan Didion and Sidney Lumet, and he wants to shoot it as a film on stage near the end of his life. I mean, like, why? I mean, is obsessed the right word for his continuing to want to return to the Deer Park?
Yeah, I think it was the great. It was the book in his life, and he has said this himself, that no book in his life cost him more or obsessed him more than The Deer Park, and he never gave up thinking about it. And if you think of all the different versions of it, including, you know, the unpublished final version of the, you know, basically a new theatrical version which he wanted to film before he died, you know, so it was a mediocre success in his life. It was a bestseller. It was an advance in his art, but it wasn't a big novel that he was promised. I think it's the best novel ever written about Hollywood in the 50s. I think it stands up with all its flaws as a great novel. Mm-hmm. I've always loved it. So I do deeply love it and admire it. But it was such a struggle for him to... This is when he was really learning how to be a professional novelist. And that was the book where all the hard lessons were learned. And then after that, it took him a while. You know, he became distracted by life and started writing nonfiction, and it was 10 years before he got back to the novel. I mean, it was such a blow to him, you know, the struggle to get that in there. And in the meantime, you know, he discovered a nonfiction style in advertisements that he carried for the rest of his life. That was the book where he forged his style, advertisements.
Sure.
And The Deer Park was the book where he really got his chops, where he really earned his chops, and he really struggled through all the problems of structuring a novel and point of view in a novel and tone and pace in a novel, all things he'd never really thought about before. He was just basically, style to him before that was just sort of a, you know, a bunch of freight cars carrying content. That's all. And then he realized that the style of a novel really made a big difference in it, and the point of view and the voice and the pace, all those things he didn't think about in Barbary Shore, and he didn't think about that much in The Naked and the Dead. All of a sudden, he thought about it. So the two, you know, pivotal books in his life, in that sense, are Before It Becomes Norman Mailer, you might say. Those are the two books that made him Norman Mailer in the full. You know, the book that, you know, many people think is his greatest book, Armies of the Night, he never really talked about that much. I mean, he loved it, he enjoyed it, and he would never disown it or anything like that. But he didn't talk about that anywhere near as much as he talked about The Deer Park or The Executioner's Song. Those were books that were, you know, filled the notion of a novelist writing about the big world out there, the world of Hollywood, and, you know, behind that was the world of Korea and the world of the McCarthy hearings. It was an American novel, and it was populated with characters and people and so on. And the same thing with The Executioner's Song. Armies of the Night was a much more in a way personal effort. While it had the background of the war in Vietnam there, of course, it still was a much more personalized effort. It was much more about him, and there was some part of him that didn't want to write about himself that much.
Sure.
They wanted to write about the wider world. Well, that was always there. There was a tension there. Yet he was very successful about writing about himself, wasn't he? And what did he finally say? I'm sick of writing about myself.
Right. But that style you speak of, is that the same thing as his interest in form over content? Because he did say that several times. He said there's a selected letters, there's a note of it, and then also in that lecture I uncovered from England, he says he's more interested in form than content. And that ties into, I think, for me, a cubist Picasso kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I think he I would say you put your finger on a tension in his writing. On the one hand, he wanted to write, you know, big novels of saturation, novels that Theodore Dreiser and Dos Passos wrote. He wanted to write novels like that. On the other hand, he liked Flaubert and the French novelists who were writing novels that had much more style. And so, you know, you try to put him in either camp, you're going to have a problem. It was a tension in his writing. He wanted, in the end, he wanted both. He wanted, the person, of course, who did both for him was Tolstoy. Tolstoy had the great style, and at the same time, he had the great vision of Russia. That's what he wanted. He wanted both. He wanted it all.
So if you come to Mailer through advertisements for myself, what is it about for you? What is it about Mailer's work that incites you to pursue it or study it or write about it or be an archivist of it? Like, what is it about Mailer's work that incites you to fall in love with it? Is it like the mysticism? Is it the politics? I mean, what drives your own Mailer work outside
of
the friendship?
Well, you know, I came to Mailer when I was in graduate school, before I wrote my dissertation. I was going to write my dissertation on Nathaniel Hawthorne. Mm-hmm. I was a student of the American Renaissance. And I always, when I came to Mailer, I really saw him in the tradition of the American Renaissance. And that was writing about the whole American experiment, about American exceptionalism, about America as the great hope of the world. And Mailer shared that idea. And that goes back all the way back to Emerson and Whitman and Thoreau and Hawthorne and Melville.
Right.
So I saw him through that. And that was the way I still see him, in the most profound way, that he was a profoundly American writer and wanted to write about the destiny of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was able to align his own destiny with the destiny of the United States, as he did, you know, for 4 or 5 years there in the late 60s, early 70s, he became, you know, his own American hero. And I think those were, you know, in many ways his most successful books, culminating in a way with Executioner's Song. You can see them all as a continuum right there. So I always saw him as an artist in the tradition of American Romanticism, late American Romanticism. I think he is a romantic. Ultimately, Norman Mailer is an American romantic, and his great heirs are Emerson and Whitman and Thoreau. And that's Dreiser, who was also an American romantic, and Dos Passos, who was too, in his own way. I think that's what drove me in. I saw that, finally. I didn't see it when I first read The Deer Park, but I saw it when I read when I read Advertisements for Myself. I saw the ambition there. I saw the Emersonian ambition. And when I read, you know, The Deer Park the first time, I didn't know anything about Emerson. And I think if you want to really understand Mailer, you really have to know Melville and Emerson.
Right.
And Hawthorne and Whitman.
Mm-hmm. You know? Sure.
He grows out of them, and, you know, when he went to Harvard, he had courses with, not courses, he went to lectures with F.O. Mathewson, who wrote the great book, you know, The American Renaissance, about all those figures.
Mm-hmm.
Mailer read it and was profoundly moved by that book.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the first great book of literary criticism that Mailer read.
So maybe, I mean, and maybe you know where my heart sort of lies in Mailer studies, and maybe it's my lone observation, but I mean, one of the things that strikes me, it's sort of an epiphany for me too, is that I'm surprised reading the selected letters how cinematic his thinking is. Like, he's someone that seems rooted in film in his own strange way. Like,
mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, like, there's going through the letters, there's numerous mentions of cinema. You know, he's suggesting books to people that he thinks would make great films. He's comparing novels on their cinematic qualities. You know, he references his marriage or his relationship at first to Beverly as being two actors. He's writing screenplays. He's working with Sergio Leone. He's, you know, recommending La Basse to Peter Bogdanovich. I mean, in his introduction to The Deer Park, a play, which you and I just talked about a little bit over email, like, he talks there of the play being film-like in its changes or scenes. And, I mean, you know, we learn what his favorite movie is. So, do you think that he was always thinking about his work in these terms? Like, why is he so taken with movies, and why does it seem to influence his thinking, do you think?
Well, it's a simple answer. He spent the Depression in the great movie palaces of New York City.
Okay.
Watching Humphrey Bogart, watching Cary Grant, watching Joan Crawford, watching Barbara Stanwyck, watching the great figures, you know, as the country is sinking into depression, these people are living fantastically interesting lives. You know, he said more than once that, you know, he thought of Humphrey Bogart as like his uncle.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
He felt that close to him. So he grew up in the golden age of American cinema.
Mm-hmm.
And then he worked for Sam Goldwyn in Hollywood.
Yes, right.
He saw it as it was moving into its period of decadence, as he saw it. But he saw still that Goldwyn was a great man, and he had very fond memories of Goldwyn all of his life. And he said Goldwyn treated him well. And so, you know, that marks him, you know. So before he goes into the army, he's had this terrific experience of the American cinema. And if you look at his essay, Superman Comes to the Supermarket,
right. Mm-hmm.
He talks about the dream life of the nation.
Yeah.
And the dream life of the nation was, you know, came from those films. In the darkened movie theaters, those great, and they were beautiful. You know, you lived in a third floor walk up, but you went to those theaters, and they were magnificent structures, and you know, you felt like you were going into a palace, and that's where he saw all those films, and he never got over that experience, and he realized how profound film culture was to the American imagination. So that was, you know, you can look at the American Romantics that I just talked about as mm-hmm. one stream that floats his boat, and the other stream that floats his boat is cinema and
yeah.
theater. And he never, you know, it was always there, and he always had ambitions for it. I mean, if you wanted what Norman Mailer's ideal life was to write a great novel in the great American Romantic tradition, take a year off, and then have a great movie in the tradition of Howard Hawks and John Huston and
right.
all the great American romantics the next year, and then go back and forth. That would be his ideal life.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Undergirded by those two experiences of reading the American romantics and seeing the great movies in the great golden age of Hollywood, you know, in the 1930s and 40s.
Yeah. Well, he's never shy, too, about expressing distaste in the letters. Like, you know, to go back to Manso a little bit and Mary Dearborn's bios, he wasn't shy about telling people how he felt about these books and how they sort of spoiled his friendships and kept tabs on the errors
mm-hmm.
in the bios.
Yeah, he had some regard for Hillary Mills's book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he thought she was a pretty brave and bold young woman to write that book, and I still think it's a wonderful biography of Mailer. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
I think she did a very honest and wonderful job. I got more out of that biography than the others. Manso, he had a lot of personal problems with that I don't want to talk about. Dearborn, you know, she did some great stuff. But there was a lot of mistakes and errors in there. On the other hand,
mm-hmm.
he didn't
yep.
give her interviews. So what could he expect, you know?
Sure, sure.
And
sure.
He actually admits that, you know. So he was never nasty to, I mean, he wrote a letter to Dearborn about the mistakes that were there, but, and there were a lot more. But, you know, she still added a lot of stuff to it. She really did some good work. So did Manso. Yeah, I think Manso was very helpful to me. I mean, his book was terrific. So, you know, you're standing on the shoulders of giants. When you write a biography, you're writing about the ones before. I had unique resources, but, you know, those four books, Carl Rollison, I thought did a wonderful job on some stuff. He was a great synthesis. He didn't do a lot of original interviewing or anything, but he had a lot of great insights. He was the most literary of the. I had those four books on my desk all the time I was writing, and every time I wrote a section, I would read what they said, you know, and quoted from them many times. You know,
sure.
That's the way you write a biography is you look at other people and you say, what can I add to this?
What's next for you in terms of the Mailer universe? Are you working on another book about Mailer?
No, I'm not. I'd like to write a memoir about his last years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm collecting information on that. And I've got a file, and I keep putting stuff in. I did a thing called the Mailer Log this last year. It's about 150,000 words. So I have that.
Okay.
Which is essentially a Boswell's life of Mailer kind of a thing. You know, I talk to him, I go home, and I'd write it down. He knew I was doing it, and I told him. So I've got that, and I've got all my notes. And so somewhere down the line, I'd like to do that. I never feel ready to do that yet, but I want to do that later. You know, I've been doing these books for Toshin.
Right.
You know, Superman Comes to the Supermarket. That's out now, and The Fight's coming out next year. Wrote an introduction to that, and I edited that, and the same with Superman. Nina was the editor. I just wrote the introduction, but, you know, I helped out here and there with that. So I'm doing those, but I'm working on, you know, another book called 16 Handshakes to Shakespeare, which is a series of biographical chapters 16 of them going from Ezra Pound all the way back to Shakespeare. You know, I shook the hand of the man, I shook the hand of the man, I shook the hand all the way back. So I'm trying to write something that's not Mailer.
Right.
I've thought about this book for years and years, and I'm doing it with my brother, mm-hmm. who's a literary man, and my son is a literary man, and so the three of us are doing it together, and we'll see. I don't know if it'll fly. You know, my editor is interested in it, and if they're interested in it, we get a contract, then I'll write it, and then they'll take a year, year and a half, and then, there's other mail, there's stuff in the archives that needs to be sifted through and sorted through and see if there's another book of, uncollected stuff there. But, that's down the line. That's down the road.
Special thanks goes out to Mike Lennon. You can purchase the Selected Letters of Norman Mailer or A Double Life on Amazon.com today. Be sure to visit Lennon's official website, jmichaellennon.com. And to join the Mailer Society, please visit normanmailersociety.org. Until next time.